Long ago, far away, life was clear. Close your eyes. Remember.
You know, that's Harry Nilsson singing a great song, Remember. And I want to tell you why we decided to start with that song today, because I think all of us in the Political Rewind team are feeling kind of nostalgic. We're thinking back to the good old days of politics, back long ago, like last Sunday, before we had the most remarkable week ever in American politics. Well, maybe not ever, that might be an exaggeration, but since Sunday, since the good old days of long ago, we learned that Donald Trump gave highly secret classified information to the foreign minister Lavrov and the ambassador Kislyak of Russia when they came into the Oval Office. Then we learned that a memo from James Comey shows that we're told that Trump asked him to end the probe against Michael Flynn, saying that he's a good guy. And then a day later, on Wednesday, we learned that Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein was going to appoint a special counsel, Robert Mueller, to take on the Russian probe. And then we started hearing tweets from our president saying that it was, in fact, the worst political witch hunt ever. Christina Torres, political reporter at the AJC. Those were the good old days before this week.
You feel like you've aged 10 years.
That's really true. Thank you for being here, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Chris Lake. Chip Lake.
It's close enough.
Who is a Republican strategist and hasn't been on. Neither of you been on for a while. And I'm really happy to have you back in here.
Thanks for having me on.
And joining us from our Macon Bureau, who another panelist who hasn't been on for a while, Charles Richardson. Charles, thank you for joining us from our bureau down there in Macon. It's a pleasure to have you back on.
It's good to be here, and my head is swimming just like everybody else's.
Well, we certainly are going to talk about what's gone on this week in Trumpian politics. By the way, the president, about a little less than an hour ago, was wheels up on Air Force One. He's on his way first to Riyadh, to Saudi Arabia, 2 days in Saudi Arabia, 2 days in Israel. He goes to the Vatican and then is in Europe for a number of meetings with European officials. So, kids, dad's gone. You can invite your friends over for a late night party.
I'm telling you, just wait till he pulls out the phone because he gets bored on the plane, and then watch out Twitter.
You can invite him over for a late night party, but it might be recorded. The audio might be recorded.
All right. Let me start by, I want to make a quick announcement. Next Tuesday night, May 23rd, we're going to be over at the Carter Presidential Library, as we are occasionally. We're going to record a two-way street, our other show here on GPB, with an author named Mark Pendergrast. He's written a book called City on the Verge. And the reason I want to mention it to our Political Rewind audience is I think it's the kind of subject that you're interested in, as you have expressed your interest in politics. What Pendergrast has written, he's taken Atlanta and says that he sees it essentially as a potential template for the rebirth of large American cities. And he goes deep on explaining all the efforts that Atlanta has made in transportation, in infrastructure of various kinds, lifestyle, and other things, to have that kind of rebirth. And he says Atlanta's either on the verge of tremendous rebirth or it's in inexorable decline. So it ought to be a fascinating conversation. And if you're available, we're going to be doing it at 7 p.m. next Tuesday night, May 23rd. We'd love to have you be a part of it and ask questions while you're there. 7 p.m., May 23rd, Carter Presidential Library. Admission is free. You do not need a reservation. But if you're going to come a little early because the seating over there is limited. Okay, enough with the announcements, but we'd love to see you all there. Christina, let me start with you with a local story before we move on. You had an interesting little piece in the AJC pointing out that this District 32 state Senate race, which was just won by the Republican.
Tuesday night.
You had an interesting story about turnout and what it says about that area up there.
You know, it's funny because you look at it and think, you know, it's a footnote and maybe a cute little headline, but it's interesting in what effect it may portend in the 6th District runoff June 20th. So we have more than 32,000 people vote, which is incredibly high, and in fact looks like a Georgia record for voter turnout in a legislative special election runoff. You know, we went back and looked through 1996, and you know, there were certain runoff elections that had gotten maybe, you know, 20,000, 23,000. One in near Macon had another election on the ballot for one that got that high. But if you think about this as a standalone, everyone thought it was supposed to be June 20th because they get mixed up on what elections win. That's incredible.
June 20th being the runoff for the 6th
District
Congressional.
Right, between John Ossoff and Karen Handels. So, you know, here you're going in, you had a much underfunded Democratic contender going against a Republican who had maybe, you can argue, certainly the financial advantage, someone who was close to Tom Price. You know, these two good candidates duking it out, more than 32,000 people showing up on a day where people really weren't sure what to expect. And I think a lot of folks think that looks like it's going to be great turnout then next month, given the interest in that same area.
Charles, I want to bring you in right away, because we are going to talk a bit about the 6th District race and have been on this show, because it has been one of the most talked about races in the United States, obviously. It is getting huge national attention. But Charles, so I'm wondering, in Macon, which is far from the 6th District.
Yes, it is.
How do you view that race, and how are the people in Macon that you talk to feeling about that race? Are they watching it with the kind of interest that people around the country are? Or do they feel this is another example of those of us in Metro Atlanta being just involved, self-involved, and not understanding the rest of the state?
Well, I can't avoid it because I get at least 3 emails from Karen Handel every day.
but only 3?
Oh, yeah, I tell you, it's just I wake up to a Karen Handel email at least every day. And, you know, I'm far from the 6th District, as you know. But as far as the rest of the population here, I think it's one of those careless races. Karen Handel, of course, is known here because her name is she's served in statewide office. Ossoff, they don't know who the heck he is. And I'm not sure anybody really cares. I think after the November elections, people wish that there was never another election in their lifetime. I think it's a very interesting election and an election at a very interesting time in our country, and all the money that's coming in from every place is also kind of fun to watch.
You know, that's interesting because I remember going out during the early vote ahead of April 18th, which was the regular special election. And it was funny because I was going and meeting all these folks who were coming to vote, but they didn't live in the district. Because they were seeing the television ads and you know, they were aware of the headlines. Now, of course, this is Metro Atlanta. It's not Macon. But it's just funny to me, that dichotomy, where you do have a nationally watched election. You have all these headlines going on, but there are parts of Georgia that say, okay, whatever.
Bill, I've never seen a special election quite like this, not only a special election, but I don't know that I've seen any election. I mean, when the books are closed on this race in Georgia 6, it very well could be between $42 and $44 million have been spent here. That is a mind-boggling amount of money. Talking about turnout and the information that Christina gave on the state Senate race, I really thought turnout in the first race in the congressional district would be somewhere between 125 and 130,000 people, which would have been an incredibly large turnout. It was in excess of 190,000. So it wouldn't shock me if we exceeded 200,000 people that vote on this special election, which is unbelievable.
And keep in mind, that looks like a midterm election. That does not look like an out-of-nowhere special election in the middle of May, you know, of June and April.
Charles, one of the things that interests me about what you said is that people around the country have seen this as a surrogate race, essentially. Mm-hmm. This is you either like Donald Trump or you don't like Donald Trump. If you like him, you vote for Karen Handel. If you don't, you vote for John Ossoff. And so in some ways, I guess I'm a little surprised that people in your area are not looking at the race in those terms, whether they really want to get down into the nitty-gritty of the race or not. This is, to some extent, whether we want it to be or not, a referendum on Trump, isn't it?
Oh, it's a referendum on Trump, I'm sure of that. But all of those millions of dollars are going basically within the sphere of the 6th District. There's not a cent being spent outside of that
area. Oh, sure, sure.
You know, and quite frankly, even as a newspaper, we have an occasional story about what's going on in the 6th District, but not really. The television stations here aren't covering it for any amount of time. You know, since we have this great thing called cable that we can't carry Atlanta television stations, none of that stuff is brought down here.
Right.
So there's really no impact. There's nothing for people to get interested in unless I opine on it somewhat on how it reflects on the national scene and create some interest that way.
And this isn't just a federal special election. This seat did not become open because the incumbent was ill and resigned or passed. This seat is open because the president took Tom Price, put him on his cabinet, but not just any cabinet position, the HHS right. secretary, which is tasked with being the architect of the repeal of Obamacare. So in many respects for Democrats, it's like getting two licks at a sucker.
Yeah, yes.
I've said before on the show, excuse me, that the last time I can recall we ever had this sort of special election, runoff election, that kind of is more about who won and lost the previous election was back in 1992. And actually the actual election I think took place the first week of January of 93. And that was when Bill Clinton, of course, won the White House against George H.W. Bush running for his second term. But Charles, you'll remember this. Paul Coverdale and White, Paul Coverdale, the Republican, and White Fowler, the Democrat, had to go to a runoff. Nobody got a majority, 50% plus one. And Charles, we all saw that race back in those days as
we
another example of a surrogate race in many ways. Clinton actually came down. He came to Macon.
Yes, he came to Macon.
To campaign for White Fowler. Didn't do Fowler a whole lot of good, did it?
No, didn't do him any good at all. But, you know, the dynamics of that race were really kind of different then because you knew that you weren't going to get the turnout in the runoff that you did in the general. You kind of knew that. And, that had been the pattern. And there was no changing of the demographics of the district so much as it is reflected in the 6th, or the hope for change in the demographics between going from red to blue. Or is it going from red to blue? Is it not? Those weren't played out. But I think you're quite right, Bill, in that okay, Clinton won. Now let's get one for the other side.
Yeah, the Republicans did turn out in that race to say
yes, they did.
We're not happy about this. I wanted to bring that up because I haven't seen him in years. I ran into Weish Fowler at the movies the other day and hadn't seen him in forever. And I don't think Weish has ever even gotten over the loss of that race. Christina, you have some interesting information about registrations in the 6th District. You did a story about it. Of course, registration was extended because suit was filed by a national voting rights organization saying that that the voters here were being denied the right to register after April 18th, that registration needed to be open again.
To be reopened. And I'm keeping in mind that the original deadline in this race was March 20th.
Right. And that suit has not been resolved in court. But while it's working its way through, the judge said, by all means, register. What are we seeing in those new registrations and how it could affect that race?
You know, the interesting part, we talked about the demographics changing in this area and what it could portend, going back even from the presidential election forward. You know, we looked at the numbers after March 20th, and there was only a 2.5% bump in new voters in that district. And that was knowing that this big race was coming, that everyone saw this as a referendum on Donald Trump's early presidency. So it's going to be interesting. The actual deadline that the judge picked is May 21st. That's this Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that anyone is expecting a huge surge, but it will be interesting to see how many people do register. Chip and I were talking, you know, you get a few hundred, even 1,000 new voters. They actually go to the polls. That could make a difference in this kind of election. So,
well, not only could it make it a difference in this type of election, but when we looked, I mean, when I saw the margins in the early votes for the first round, I was really thinking we wouldn't make it to a second round. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not unusual to see a little bit of a difference between what happens in early voting and what happens on Election Day voting. But the difference on the first round was substantial. So I expect that to be the case here as well. And then the question would be, what percentage of the electorate votes on Election Day? The higher that percentage is, the better Karen Handel's chances are of winning are going to be.
We're not going to spend a great deal of time on the 6th District today because we have been and we will continue to right up until June 20th. But I want to take a break right now. When we come back, I do want to play one new spot that's been put on the air, pro-Karen Handel spot, because it's a response to a Ossoff attack ad that we aired the other day, and out of fairness, if nothing else, want to hear the other side of it. We'll explain it when we come back. But there's also some really significant, or what appears to be significant, breaking news that Lisa Clark has just brought into the studio, and it has to do with Trump and Comey. And we'll get to that in a moment, too. I do want to tell you, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPP. Jim Galloway continues on vacation, but he's tweeting anyway. We have two tweets from Jim.
Good for Jim.
He's in Scotland. Came here to escape politics, he tweets. But here in Inverness, I just saw Robert Mueller rising out of Loch Ness. But I am listening, he says in a separate tweet. One other quick tweet that I think deserves some attention. KTWO, who tweets as K Schmooze, asks a really important question. I'm confused. Mueller called by some counsel and prosecutors by other. What's the difference? Which is appropriate here? So I'm going to explain it, and I'd love to have both of you weigh in if you know. Charles, you jump in too. Okay. Number one, there really is no difference at all between special counsel or special prosecutor. Those are basically interchangeable terms. What is different is that whatever you call that person, she or he, is appointed by the Justice Department, by the Attorney General, in this case, the Deputy Attorney General, and serves at the pleasure of the AG, and because of that, at the pleasure of the president. Back in the 90s, in the 80s really, with Iran-Contra, we had independent counsels who were appointed by a three-judge panel. They could not be dismissed by the president of the United
Correct.
States, right? Yeah. Have I got that right, everybody?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. That law expired in, I think, believe, 99.
Yeah, they got tired of it because Iran-Contra got out of control. And then they did it with Clinton over all the Whitewater business issues. And people on the Hill, both parties, thought it just got out of control. So they allowed that statute to expire. So whether you call it a special counsel or a special prosecutor, that person, Robert Mueller, serves at the pleasure, ultimately, of the President of the United States. And that is significant. All right, let's get a break out of the way. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We'll be back in a moment.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start. And by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Christina Torres from the AJC, Chip Lake, Republican strategist, and in the Macon Bureau, Charles Richardson, a columnist and editorial director of the Macon Telegraph. I do want to give you the breaking news within the last few minutes. Lisa just handed this to me, so I will try to digest it fairly quickly. The New York Times it reports this. Here's their lead. President Trump told Russian officials in the Oval Office this month that firing the FBI director James B. Comey had relieved, quote, great pressure, unquote, on him, according to a document summarizing the meeting. And here's a quote. I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy, a real nut job, unquote, Mr. Trump said, according to the document, which was read to the New York Times by an American official. Quote, I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off, unquote. And then Mr. Trump, according to the Times, added, I'm not under investigation. Charles, that is another startling and astonishing story about the president, how he talks so freely, of course, with Russians in the Oval Office, but then once again seeming to implicate himself as getting rid of Comey to stop the Russia investigation.
You know, how do you say nut job in Russian? You know, the poor translator was probably just going crazy, but they're all self-inflicted wounds. And then the optics of being in a meeting with basically an underling below your level, a foreign minister and an ambassador, in a meeting that you've excluded the American press, and you've got the Russian press there, and then you say stuff like this, and you blow off your other big toe, and all this last week, we see him shoot toe after toe after toe after toe, and now it is just flabbergasting that you would say this kind of stuff to a country that, quite frankly, we've had a cold war with for a long time.
So, Christina and Chip, I want to get you involved in this conversation, too. But let me add another story that just broke from the Washington Post, which, by the way, is the newspaper war between the Washington Post and the New York Times right now is absolutely extraordinary.
But someone mentened to me yesterday, you just might as well give the Pulitzer this year, just hand them out now.
Yeah. Yeah, this is another significant story in the investigation. Here's what the Post is reporting. This story, they moved it at 3:02, so it's pretty fresh. The law enforcement investigation into possible coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign has identified a current White House official as a significant person of interest, showing that the probe is reaching into the highest levels of government, according to people familiar with the matter. Chip, a person of interest is a very specific, if in fact they're using that term, law enforcement designation. It means that person is, in fact, under investigation.
It does. And going back to the news that you just broke on the president calling Comey a nut job, you know, when the original, kind of hubbub from that meeting came out with respect to the intelligence that he shared with the Russians about the laptops that were being produced in the Middle East that could blow up airplanes. You know, Henry McMaster was in that meeting, and he sent Henry McMaster up to the White House press room to explain what happened. It'll be interesting to see if he denies the fact or even addresses the fact that he addressed Comey or talked about firing that quote nut job, and if he does, what McMaster has to say about it. Look, at the end of the day, this special counsel, special prosecutor, there is a big distinction in the fact that if you're a Republican right now, it's a special counsel. If you're a Democrat right now, it's a special prosecutor. Yeah. But I think it's bad news, not only for the president, but it's bad news for those that were in the campaign. I don't know who that person would be in the White House. Perhaps it's Steve Bannon. I don't know. Probably the closest relationship with a lot of those people, Carter Page and others. But Paul Manafort is probably in a little bit of deep trouble right now, and I don't know how this ends or when it ends, but it doesn't look good or
so,
smell good.
Christina, one of the things I find really important about these two stories breaking just as the president was wheels up
right,
to
and
head,
within minutes of each other.
Yes, is that there is no question that the White House is hoping that this trip to Saudi Arabia, to Israel,
right,
is going to change the narrative, give them an opportunity to breathe a little bit, get out from under these scandals. These two stories are potentially so significant that at least for the first part of this trip, they're not going to be able to change
the
narrative.
I think it was always clear, certainly the reports out of Washington were clear, that this was something they had hoped would be a reset, right? An American leader who you know, usually they go abroad and they look bigger on that stage. I'm sure they're still hoping that, but the reports today are coming after the reports yesterday from that all-senator meeting, which they walked out and started talking about a criminal investigation. And this is coming as, you know, some people think it's a double-edged sword for Democrats who maybe want public hearings so the public can hear about this, but that's not likely now. Given that there is concern, this is now a criminal investigation. Now this report that there is a person of interest at the White House, a senior advisor. So
could he be on the trip?
Could that individual
be on the plane and on the trip?
Oh, my God. Charles, when I said that I think the White House is going to have a hard time getting out from under this, I mean, when the president the first time the president has a public appearance in Saudi Arabia where there's an opportunity for American press that's on this trip to ask him questions, based on these stories, they're not going to be asking him about Saudi Arabia. They're going to try to drill down on this story. And the same is going to happen to the other high-level White House people who are on that trip.
And he just took off. He's going to be in the plane for 12 hours, so there's no telling what else will break by the time that happens.
Absolutely. And what the president doesn't seem to grasp, and even from I tell this of local people, every organization leaks, and the administration right now is under pressure. The more you put certain things under pressure, the more they leak, and you're going to see things like this roll out throughout, until it's just gushers everywhere, and the Washington Post and the New York Times are having a field day. I mean, their tip lines are lighting up like a Christmas tree, with all the things that the tips they're getting. I'm sure they can't even run them all down in real time.
And we haven't even had the first round of staff departures yet, which I think is coming. And so when you do have the first round of staff departures, the floodgates will open even more.
Well, and there was some talk that there were leaks that some of his staff were hoping that would get his attention and hopefully change his behavior.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, we will watch these stories unfold in the next couple of days, of course. And we are going to continue to talk on the show today a little bit more about this remarkable week in American politics. Including, I think it's worth actually mentioning right now, because of the fact that we've seen these two big, big news stories today. I mean, all week, the Washington Post and the New York Times have been socking it out on the front pages of the papers.
And they did trade a little Twitter love today. So
oh, they did?
They did, if you look at their Twitter feeds. So I think they recognize the good work each is doing.
Well, okay, so... Here's the thing, though, for all three of you. I want to be – I said on the show the other day that we were going to be a no-impeachment zone, that I have no interest in contributing to the conversation that some in the media have begun, and that some, frankly, Democrats on the Hill and others have begun about, maybe we're moving toward impeachment, starting to look at stories about how is a president impeached, all that. I personally think it would be irresponsible and way too premature to even begin having those conversations on this show, for a lot of reasons that we don't have to go into right now. And I know there's a concern in the media that as this huge newspaper war plays out, that more and more Americans who are on the other side, who support Donald Trump, see the media as a genuine enemy. And I want to read you something. Bob Woodward, who is about as legitimate a journalist as we have in this country right now. Here's an interesting story. Veteran journalist Bob Woodward called on the national media Friday to keep focused on reporting straight news after many reporters have revealed a bias against President Trump. Friday on MSNBC, Woodward said he knows of too many reporters who have strayed from objectivity and shown an excessive hostility toward the White House. Stick to the reporting, he said. Stick to the reporting. One of the realities we have here is we have a good old newspaper war going on, the New York Times and Washington Post, some very powerful stories. At the same time, I think it's time to dial back a little bit because there are people around who are kind of binge drinking the anti-Trump Kool-Aid, and this is not going to work in journalism. Let the politicians have that binge drink. Charles, that's the sort of thing I could imagine you writing a column about.
Well, certainly so. I think there's something that I always use. I say just the facts. Within those news pages, except on the editorial pages, it should be just the facts. The facts should speak for themselves. You source, you source, you source, you write what the sources say, you verify those sources, and you just the facts. I think anything beyond that, you describe as analysis, if you will, but I think if people perceive that you're going after anybody beyond that, I think you're going to run into problems. You're going to run into problems of charges of bias.
Well, and it feeds into that idea of fake news, right? Coming right. off the campaigns and sort of what news was legitimate and what was not. You know, of course, you have to stick to the facts.
It's okay. Good. Thank you. I'm glad we all agree on that. Next Wednesday. On this show, we're already beginning to put together our ideas for how we want to discuss this very topic in more depth. Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, which I think is just about as good an NPR show as you could ever want to listen to, will be back joining us again. And we're going to have a much more in-depth conversation exactly about this subject. And one of the questions we're going to ask, Chip, is the bad news being reported about Donald Trump because the media has a bias against Donald Trump, or is it because the media is accurately reporting the troubling and, in some cases, dishonest things happening in the Trump White House?
Bill, it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, at the end of the day, this president, who I want to succeed, has trouble telling the truth a lot. And he has trouble with facts. And so if that's the case, you kind of have to do that. And look, it's not a secret to a lot of us. I didn't think he'd win the primary and I was wrong. I didn't think he'd win the general election and I was wrong. But I had concerns about how he would govern. And I think I was right so far on how he was going to govern. And so, you can't continue to behave as president the way you did as a candidate, continuing to fight every day. I mean, you know, it's one thing to push back at the media and you have to do that. But if you're going to be fighting with them every day, it's like going to a casino every day and trying to leave with more money than the house. It's not going to happen.
Well, in the same way that picking fights with the law enforcement community is never going to serve.
And the intelligence community. And,
well, that's what I mean. I should have said that. That's what I mean. Yeah. Thank you for correcting that. You just don't want to pick a fight with the CIA, do you, Charles?
No.
No, that old adage about fighting with somebody that buys ink by the barrel,
yeah,
it still applies.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yes. You know what? We got so much more to talk about. I did promise we were going to do a little more on the 6th District race, but those two headlines, we just had to get to them right away. So let's get our second break of the show out of the way right now. And come back, and we'll talk a little more Trump. We'll also talk a little more 6th District. There's a few other really interesting political stories on one of the biggest weeks, certainly I can remember, as a political reporter in my 35 years of doing it. And I think most people would absolutely agree with that. This is Political Rewind.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, a major contributor to the economic and cultural vitality of downtown Atlanta and the metro Atlanta area.
This weekend, audiences will hear this live for the very last time.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the greatest show.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The end of 146 years of circus history this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is this afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
Wow, that promo is louder than I am. And I know, pretty loud on this show. Welcome back to a Political Rewind. Christina Torres is with us, Chip Lake, and Charles Richardson of the Macon Telegraph. So let's, I'm trying to, there are so many directions to go. I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and finish off what we want to say about this big week in national politics. And then we'll talk some more about the 6th district race. And then I want to get to some of your really terrific tweets today. Let's start with this. We have a couple of sound bites of President Trump, who yesterday did a news conference. He was had just come from a meeting with the president of Colombia. They came out and appeared together at podiums in the White House. And, of course, the first question from an American journalist was about whether or not Trump in any way tried to get Comey off the Mike Flynn investigation.
I think it's totally ridiculous. Everybody thinks so. And, again, we have to get back to working our country properly so that we can take care of the problems that we have. We have plenty of problems. We've done a fantastic job. We have a tremendous group of people, millions and millions of people out there that are looking at what you had just said and said, what are they doing? Director Comey was very unpopular with most people. I actually thought when I made that decision, and I also got a very, very strong recommendation, as you know, from the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. But when I made that decision, I actually thought that it would be a bipartisan decision, because you look at all of the people on the Democratic side, not only the Republican side, that was saying such terrible things about Director Comey. Then he had the very poor performance on Wednesday. That was a poor, poor performance. So poor, in fact, that I believe, and you'd have to ask him, because I don't like to speak for other people, but I believe that's why the Deputy Attorney General went out and wrote his very, very strong letter.
Okay, so what we learned yesterday, though, from Rod Rosenstein's testimony, he went up to brief yesterday members of the Senate. Today he's up, was up on the Hill to brief the House. What we learned yesterday was that he knew long before he wrote the memo that President Trump planned to fire Jim Comey. So we still have the president not lined up with what his deputy attorney general is saying.
I think there's this idea of, you know, these reports that are coming out saying, you know, number one, this concern that maybe you need to lawyer up. But number two, stop talking. Right.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Have you ever tried to diagram one of President Trump's sentences? You know, the things that you learned how to diagram a sentence in probably middle school.
Wait, he's a New Yorker, though, right?
So that's how New Yorkers talk.
I grew up a little bit in New Jersey, so maybe that's just me. But
you know, it still has to be a complete sentence sometimes.
Agreed.
You know, and he pops all over the place. And if you read a deputy attorney general's letter, he doesn't recommend anything. You know, it's plain English. He says what he says, but he doesn't recommend Comey's firing. Why would he when he already knew that Comey was going out the door?
Yeah, I'd love to go back and look at the letter, because I was under the impression that at some place in that letter there was a reference to the fact that I've come to the conclusion that you have. Well, not that you have, but I've come to the conclusion it's time for him to go. Do I have that wrong, Charles? You may have the letter there.
Yeah, okay. I've read the letter.
Okay.
Because I think he knows that that's the president's job.
Okay.
I mean, he can make a case why he should be going.
Oh, okay.
But that's the president's job.
All right.
I think you went as far as saying that it was his opinion that the Bureau had lost confidence in their
leader. There you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
Christina's handing me we got some tweets, right? Is that what we're looking at? You tell me.
These from Air Force One?
We do have a tweet from Tim Echols. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah.
Tim Echols says, wow, he's, of course, a public service commissioner. Wow, this from Nygut on National Media Circus. People are binge drinking the anti-Trump Kool-Aid. I was quoting Bob Woodward. Who said that, Mr. Eccles? But I'm glad you're listening, as you often do.
I think
do.
Trump's feeding it to him in a syringe.
So we said that Rosenstein was up talking to members of the House today. And as they came out, of course, they were confronted by a lot of reporters wanting to know what went on. Probably one of the more interesting sound bites is from Congressman Darrell Issa. You know, Issa over the years, Chip, has been one of the most conservative voices in the U.S. House, but he finds himself suddenly in a district that is really, really volatile, where Democrats are starting to move strongly. And so he's been changing his tune lately. Fair way to set up what he said?
Well, yeah, and I don't know that his election was settled until December. Yeah. I think he had the closest election of any Republican that won re-election last year, and so I think that's an accurate assessment.
All right, so let's listen to what Issa had to say when he came out of the Rothstein session.
The definition of fair will not be a Republican definition. They won't like it. A Democratic definition, at times they won't like it. And the president, at times, will be frustrated. But, you know, again, this is about public confidence. And I think most importantly, this will not be a partisan activity, even though partisans will complain one way or the other. But we need to have public confidence. And, you know, the American people aren't Republicans or Democrats. They're the American people. They deserve the answers wherever those, you know, that information.
So Issa is one of the Republicans who increasingly are saying, yeah, we need to let this go forward. There was a time when there might have been more pushback on this, Christina, but now Republicans are saying, nope, we do need to get to the bottom of this.
Well, I think it's the idea of let this probe go forward. Robert Mueller has a very good reputation. Folks on both sides have said that. Let it move forward. Stop talking. Let the results lie where they may.
Democrat Elijah, did you want to weigh in?
I was going to say back to I think I have a lot of respect for Tim Echols. I'm glad he's listening to the show. Back to his point about the anti-Trump Kool-Aid. There's nothing else to drink right now. If you want to defend Donald Trump, you've got nothing to go on. And there I say that as a Republican. What do you got to go on? And so it's been a tough 2 weeks, and it'll be very interesting to see where this trip goes, and then the next 2 or 3 weeks after that.
And I think part of the idea I think is the stop talking idea. Just say let it move forward, and let's talk about tax policy or let's talk about health care.
Yeah, Speaker tried to do that this week. That's exactly right, Charles. When Paul Ryan held a news conference this week and tried to talk, get back on point, get on the agenda, he frankly was laughed at by an awful lot of people because he was so out of touch with the reality, especially of what was happening this week.
Well, the same thing that worked for Trump during the campaign is working against him now. He dominated the airways. He dominated the ratings because he's an outsized personality. Well, he's still an outside personality. And when he opens up his mouth and takes out his revolver and blows off his toe, he sucks the air out of the room. The news cycle is dominated by him. And so nothing else gets out to the public. It just happens that way. That's a skill that he has that worked for him. Now it's working against him.
Let me take an opportunity to do a couple tweets here, and then we're going to move back. And I do, as I said, want to talk a little more about the 6th District. Teresa English tweets, Charles, you can't speak for all of us in Macon. Many of us are paying attention to the 6th and even volunteering. Sam Burnham says, what does it say that so many showed up to vote but had no idea it wasn't in their district? Well, among other things, I think, Christina, it says there was so much excitement about the race, but it does say people aren't sure where they live and what congressional district. Or they certainly, if they don't know their congressional district, goodness knows they don't know who their state senator or their state rep
is. Well, we should point out that the Secretary of State's office, there is a way to check online. Yeah. If you have any questions on the My Voter Page site, you can get through
the
Secretary
of State's
website.
That's a really good thing to share with people.
So absolutely check before you go. When I talked to these people and said, well, gee, you came in and you can't vote, they had seen the TV ads, they had heard the radio. I mean, it was sort of that the glut of advertisement and things going on, talking to friends and in that kind of interest.
Stanford Brown tweets, I live in Macon and I have contributed to the Ossoff campaign. Khalid tweets, what did we talk about in Georgia before John Ossoff? No, really, I don't remember. great tweet. We have a few more here. from, well, Sam Burnham, thank you. He says, thanks to Bill for not grandstanding stories about the I word, the impeachment word, professionalism. I appreciate that. We try to kind of stay steady in a very tough time to do that. So just a few of the tweets that we've got, and I appreciate your sending them in. All right. Christina, I promised that we would kind of, it's essentially kind of fair play here. On Wednesday, we played a spot that the Ossoff people put up, or one of the super PACs. I frankly don't know which. Which attacked Karen Handel because while she was an executive at the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Organization, the Planned Parenthood story started blowing up. Resistance to Planned Parenthood. And I think somebody corrected, said they were correcting me on this, but I thought it was at the time the tapes were released, the undercover tapes allegedly showing a member of Planned Parenthood selling fetal body parts. But however it happened, Susan Komen cut off, defunded Planned Parenthood while Handel was in this high-level job. It was a storm of controversy, clearly. And Handel resigned under, we think, pressure, but has denied vociferously that she was the one who was responsible, even though she was an anti-Planned Parenthood person for a long time.
Well, certainly. I mean, and she has said, you know, she got there, that there was a plan in place to do this already, that she became sort of the scapegoat for what happened. You know, she's written a book talking about that experience. So, you know, depending how you view it, it's going to be a partisan issue either way.
Well, it was a smart ad for the Ossoff people to put up, in the sense that clearly it's an ad that appeals to women. If you're trying to say that you think Handel was responsible for defunding Planned Parenthood in a way. But the Handel people have now pushed back hard. And since we played the attack the other day, I want you to hear the ad that Karen Handel's folks have put up. It features Chip, a good friend of hers, and you're aware of who this person is?
Ann Lewis, an attorney here in Atlanta who I believe is not only Karen's friend, but Karen's attorney, and I was also the state party attorney, very good attorney.
Let's listen.
I'm Ann. I'm currently fighting cancer. When I see ads attacking Karen Handel, they make me sick. Karen is one of the strongest advocates for women's health I know. She stands up for us, and she stands by us when we need her most. I know because she's one of my best friends. Ignore the attacks. Let's elect a woman we can count on.
You got it? I think we've lost Christina's microphone. We got it? Go ahead.
There you go.
I appreciate that. Just really quickly, I think that's a really smart ad. You know, it goes back to the idea of Planned Parenthood largely provides health care services, right? And that's the idea the Ossoff campaign is going to push forward. It's not abortion. This is a vital service. This organization provides a vital service to communities in need with health care services, not abortion.
Yeah.
Sure. To come back and then say, no, you know,
she's on my side, as a woman,
I have this personal story, and I know this person and where she's coming from.
I think there's been a lot of smart advertising in this race, a lot of it attacks, and it's always unfortunate to see the mud being thrown, but they've been some really interesting TV ads in this race, I think. Charles, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, you know, I think that the personal quality of the ad sort of reaches out and grabs you, because one, she knows the candidate. Two, she is fighting a health issue, and she can speak directly to it about not only the health issue, but to the candidate.
Okay. I wanted to get that in. One of the biggest stories of the day, we are not going to have the time that we should to really go into it in depth, because it's a very important story. It was on the front page of your paper this morning, Christina.
It was a very good story.
Immigration arrests rise sharply in Georgia. Immigration arrests are up 75% in the what's essentially the first quarter plus. In the Atlanta ICE, Immigration Control and Enforcement area, but that area is both Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina.
Correct, yes.
Nevertheless, 75% increase. And it tells us that every now and then a story like this emerges, but these things are happening more quietly than we realize, I think, until the story breaks that so many people are being deported.
It's. I think it depends where you live,
right.
What community you live
fair
in.
Fair enough,
certainly.
Fair enough.
I think the story was from Jeremy Redman, yes. Who's our immigration reporter and an excellent reporter. I think in the same story, he notes deportations are down. Over the same period. This, of course, is the comparison. But, you know...
So, wait. He's saying that arrests are up, but deportations are
down. I believe so.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I'm looking at that.
Yeah.
Okay. He also points out that 25% of those arrests are people who have had no criminal conviction.
Correct, which is also up. That is also
right.
An increase. You know, we're talking about a week where there have been, I believe, a couple deaths in ICE detention centers in Georgia. There's, in terms of the folks who are interested in the immigration issues, there was a Dreamer, a recipient of DACA, Jessica Colodal, who is essentially the Trump administration has moved to deport her, and she is suing to stay here. There's going to be a rally, I think, tomorrow downtown in support of her. But, of course, the argument being that this administration ran on getting tough on those who are here without permission.
Charles, what are you seeing down in middle Georgia in terms of arrests?
Well, I can tell you, you've got farmers that are shaking in their boots. I was at an Future Farmers of America convention a couple of weeks ago, and the blueberry, particularly, farmers are shaking because unlike many of the other crops that are going to be going into the harvesting season, blueberries really go straight from the field straight to market. And if they aren't picked at the right time, they're gone. I mean, they're gone. But you're coming into the blueberry season. You got cabbages. You got onions. You got all kinds of things that are going to have to come out the field. And if you've got people afraid to come pick your crop, they've got serious issues that are going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, Chip, I got to think, and we're really running out of time, but I want to get your quick response to this. I really have to think that Republicans are coming more and more to regret that given an opportunity under George W. Bush, when he was president, to come up with a comprehensive immigration reform plan, they could have put it to bed. Because now you do have this issue where there are people out there who rely on the work of undocumented immigrants, and it doesn't. And Republicans have a hard time with this issue.
Well, they got a really hard time with this issue, and you know, one of the reasons we have so much illegal immigration in this country is because our legal immigration system is broken. So the frustration with not being able to pass comprehensive immigration reform was, okay, if you're opposed to it because it's not hard enough, then in reality, you're supporting de facto amnesty because that's what we have today.
And to be clear, those who may be migrant workers are not necessarily illegal.
That's right.
But it is the idea of it driving fear that I can be, if I have brown skin or maybe I speak with an accent, I may be sort of profiled, whether I'm here legally or not.
All right. Boy, that hour went fast. We are completely out of time. Charles Richardson, what a pleasure to have you back. I always look forward to reading your columns in the Macon Telegraph. Christina Torres, your byline always jumps out at me in the AJC. And Chip Lake, you're just always a really good member of this panel.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Another big week. Thank you to Jenny Ahmed, Tyler Morris, and Lisa Clark. As we leave you, Air Force One winging its way to Riyadh for the beginning of the president's trip. Peter, Paul, and Mary serenading him as he goes. See you on Monday.
Tell me that you wait for me. Hold me like you'll never